Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In some schools across the country, kids whose parents can't afford to pay for lunch can face the consequences in humiliating ways. In Alabama, school officials stamped the words, "I need lunch money," on a child's hand. In other schools, the policy is to throw away the food, make children work for lunch, or feed them a slice of cheese with bread. New Mexico lawmakers recently decided to ban such lunch shaming. It's more important, they say, that a child is properly fed when it comes to learning during the day. And you would be hard-pressed to find a nutritionist who would disagree with that notion. Jenny Lang is president of the School Nutrition Association of Ohio. She joins us by phone from Mentor, Ohio, where she supervises the lunch programs at Mentor Public Schools and Kirtland Local Schools. Welcome to the show, Jenny Lang.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also by phone, the president of the New Mexico Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, Patricia Keene. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Patty, what was the tipping point for New Mexico lawmakers in taking up this bill and passing it?
Well, you know, I have to say, too, and New Mexico Appleseed, who were really the brain trust behind this, they've been working on this for many, many years. And Senators Padilla and Lopez, the co-sponsors of the bill, really demonstrated a tremendous amount of leadership, I think, in putting it forward. You know, but New Mexico has, we are second or first in child hunger in the United States. We vacillate sort of between New Mexico and Mississippi. We trade places each year for the highest rates of children in households without consistent access to food. And we're currently both at 27%. But it's also important to remember that's an average. So actually in our highest income counties, that rate is of course, much lower, closer to 16%, whereas in other counties, it's as high as 39%. So that's essentially 4 out of 10 kids without consistent access to food. And we know the impacts of that in children is so pervasive and so long-lasting in terms of academic impacts, health impacts, including mental health. And, you know, and also, frankly, and Senator Padilla has been very open, you know, that he himself went through this as a child, and that certainly, you know, pushed forward the heart of the bill, I think, as well.
I heard an interview with Senator Padilla about that as a child. He remembers being forced to clean the lunch tables in order to kind of work for his food, right? And I was wondering, though, what, I mean, and I think in that same interview, I heard him say that this has been introduced time after time after time. Do you know if it's something that's being dealt with in other states around the country? We know New Mexico is the first, but are other state lawmakers dealing with this?
You know, I'm not sure the extent to which that is happening. I think it sounds like from what, you know, and it's been great that this has generated so much, so much media attention, whether or not, because it, more than likely it has been happening in other states where they're trying to get this through. And, you know, kudos to New Mexico really for leading the way. If it does, if it does, is the tipping point, you know, for other states to enact it as well. I think it's one of these things too, that so often for a lot of us who do this work, we sort of forget that other people who maybe aren't in our field realize that these things are happening. And so we sometimes take for granted, you know, how important the just raising the awareness of these issues is to move the needle. And so I think that's the other thing, is just building that awareness across the state. So it's been fantastic that it's gotten as much coverage as it has.
You are listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about lunch shaming when kids don't have enough money to pay for their lunch, how they're forced to work for it or just given a slice of cheese and a piece of bread instead. Some have had to watch their lunch get thrown away. You just heard from Patricia Keene. She's president of the New Mexico Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And New Mexico state lawmakers have banned such lunch shaming. Also with us, Jenny Lang. She's president of the School Nutrition Association of Ohio. Jenny Lang, you must have been paying attention when this happened in New Mexico, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Been following it very closely, actually.
What about Ohio?
Ohio has not created any specific legislation to this. We will, across the country, by July 1, the USDA has said that we have to all have a policy in school districts that talks about unpaid meal charges. It's certainly not to this extent of lunch shaming, though we have seen incidents of this in other cafeterias across the United States, and it's very unfortunate.
I'm trying to figure out who actually does the shaming. I mean, is it a principal? Is it the lunch lady? I mean, who's given the authority to do this kind of a thing anyways? Where does it fall in Ohio? Is it just up to the district?
I actually believe that there's a great deal of pressure, of course, on staff to ensure that they don't have too much negative debt sitting on their books. And so, unfortunately, some staff members take it upon themselves to think that they have the right to talk to a student that way. Being very proactive, one of the first things that I know most of us as directors do is start off our school year with making everyone aware no student ever leaves here hungry. We feed all children, whether they have funds on their accounts or not.
Patty Keene, in New Mexico, what about free lunch programs? That's a really common way to measure poverty levels and so forth in districts around Ohio. Aren't there free lunches?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have in New Mexico, it's about 60% of kids who qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And then sort of within that, it's about 50% that actually qualify for free lunch. So It's really only about 10% that are in that reduced category, and then the remaining 40% would be full price lunch. And that brings up a very good point. You know, these are for the school kids who qualify for free lunch, this isn't necessarily an issue in terms of the unpaid debt issue. There's other issues around stigma, of course. But it's really the kids more on that reduced meal rate, or it could even be the kids who are full pay. And I think that's an important, you know, the other thing that this bill does, the shaming piece is what's gotten so much coverage, but what perhaps hasn't gotten as much media attention, it really strengthens the requirements around connecting families who may be eligible for free and reduced price meals to access them. And it's really in everyone's best interest for families who qualify to be able to do that. And the other thing, too, is with respect to the unpaid balances, it really triggers the school to have to find out when they have, you know, repeated unpaid balances, to find out what's happening at home. So it's looking at, you know, does the family need additional support, et cetera? And I think that's a really important part in this. And then certainly, you know, and Jenny can speak to this, I'm sure, much more than I can, but, you know, the need, what's also, you know, important to remember here, too, is that schools need these funds. And school nutrition programs, they need those funds in order to operate. And so when those debts do go unpaid, you know, it's a tremendous disadvantage to the school, particularly when we want them to serve healthier meals and we want them to be, you know, financially solvent to do that. And certainly the more kids that we can get on the free and reduced program that qualify, the better. Now, the other thing we also have here, too, and states have this, you know, is there's community eligibility, so that if there is, you know, and many schools in New Mexico qualify for this, where there are just so many kids who qualify that the entire school is universal free. Mm-hmm. And that eliminates all of these problems, mm-hmm. right? And so it eliminates the paperwork burden for schools, but then, you know, needless to say, it reduces that stigma where everyone eats, and everyone eats together, and everyone is the same.
Jenny Lang, can you give me some ideas about what school districts, or like, what do they do where you work? I mean, what's the program there?
Okay. The program we have is probably 25% of our students are free and reduced. We can tell, and one thing I pride myself on with my staff is telling them, if you see a student sitting out there that's not eating, we need to find out why they're not eating. We always want to ensure that every child has a meal. And even when they have mounting debt, it's been where I will take the lead and try to contact that family, see what we can do about getting them assistance, find out how we can best help them. Many families feel that stigma or are afraid their children will be labeled or somehow identified, and they don't want to worry about that. And, of course, with all the point-of-sale systems where children either put in a PIN number or something like that, there's very little on transaction of funds that actually happen at the register anymore. Everything is a direct deposit from the parents' charge cards or checking account directly into the student's meal balance. So we really, you can't overtly identify who's paid, who's free, who's reduced.
Well, what do you do? I mean, so
we
you take it upon yourself, you contact the parents, and you deal with probably a myriad of
different issues. What's going on. The one thing that I will say is we have to come to some kind of terms of what we can do to assist this family and to help them, because we do not want any child to go without a well-balanced meal. That's very important, just as important as textbooks are. A child that is hungry is a child that can't think. So it's very important that even in my position, we all work harder to figure out what's going on. Food insecurities anymore are such a rising problem in this country, and children should not have to be faced with that. It's really our job to figure out how we can best recover the funds and feed these children. And if we can get them on some kind of social programs or even a regular routine payment plan, something that helps us keep our program solvent, it's a win-win for everybody.
I know there's been, it's in a lot of schools, having a breakfast is also part of the daily nutrition plan. Is that the case in New Mexico, Patricia Keene?
Yeah, in fact, and that's another piece of legislation that New Mexico Appleseed, who was behind behind Senate Bill 374, also introduced some years ago. So at breakfast after the bell, all schools who participate in the school breakfast program, most schools participate in that, but in particular, breakfast after the bell requires that children in low-income schools, that they are served a breakfast, in accordance with dietary guidelines, after the instructional day has begun. And what that means is, because a lot of kids, they may not be able to sort of make it to breakfast if it's served before the school day starts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is, New Mexico lags behind in many instances on child well-being. We're consistently last in child well-being and out of all the states. But there are some things we do really well, and breakfast after the bell is one of them. And so that we're kind of between the first and the third highest in the nation who are meeting the needs of low-income children with regard to breakfast. And so those types of innovative programs are really important, too. And it's a bonus for the schools because it increases participation in those programs. And so they're getting that reimbursement then from USDA for serving those meals.
And Jenny Lang, real quick, could you give us a sense about how much a school lunch costs and what goes into it these days?
Sure. It depends on grade level,
right,
of course. And it varies. I have to say it is variable according to the demographics of the state. There are very poor counties, and so quite honestly, they try to keep meal prices as affordable as possible. We all do.
Are we talking about a couple bucks a meal or less than that?
Well, our average meal, and I don't have statistics for the state of Ohio, but school lunch can run anywhere from $1.65 in an elementary right up to $2.65. And then it escalates up maybe a few more quarters, depending on the age level, because they're getting more food the older they get. But it's a balanced meal. It has 100% whole grains in it. You have a protein in it. You have fruits and vegetables, and of course, non-fat or 1% milk. So it's a well-balanced meal. And we want students to have that. And same with breakfast. We're even going into supper programs in the state of Ohio. Mm-hmm. It's almost like we're now feeding them for the majority of their day. Mm-hmm. We have backpack programs where students that need additional support because they're on their own, we're putting together backpack supplies for them to have to carry them through during the weekends and holidays.
Jenny Lang, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Jenny Lang, president of the School Nutrition Association of Ohio. Also, Patricia Keene, president of the New Mexico Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Thanks to you as well, Patty.
Thank you.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Surgeon General has identified loneliness and isolation as major health issues. And according to new research, lonely people who fall ill are more likely to report severe runny nose, sneezing, and other cold symptoms. We want to talk about the connection between illness and loneliness. John Cacioppo is a neuroscientist and social psychologist at the University of Chicago and co-author of the 2009 book Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's the difference between loneliness and being alone?
Being alone is an objective description of a person's circumstance. Loneliness is feeling like you're isolated, and one can feel isolated even when they're alone or when they're with others. But you can also be alone and not feel isolated at all. For instance, if you're writing or if you're doing art or music, practicing for a performance, you're unlikely to actually feel alone, even though you may be alone.
Has the incidence of loneliness changed in the United States in recent decades?
There was a paucity of actual data to address that, and the suspicion was that it had risen considerably. We now have longitudinal studies that give us a clearer picture. It has risen not dramatically, but kind of the surprise from these studies that have been done both in America and in other industrialized countries is the prevalence. It's higher than people thought. About 5 to 10% of the population in most industrialized countries feel lonely frequently or always. And about another 40% feel lonely at least sometimes. So we're talking about almost half the population struggling with periods of loneliness and 10% of the population dealing with it on a continuing basis.
Are there any particular demographics associated with loneliness?
The strongest demographic predictor is marital status and being an immigrant. Age is surprisingly unrelated to loneliness. It's within this lifespan. It's slightly higher in adolescence and in very late life. But age is a very weak predictor. Weaker than one thinks. Gender isn't a strong predictor. Immigrant status, because you've often left friends and families and familiar cultures behind, and so it's fairly easy to feel isolated in a new community. And marital status, because Usually, one has a strong confidence in their marital partner, and that's one of the features that mitigates or lowers loneliness.
You know, I was surprised to read that lots of times younger people are lonely, particularly that more transient younger population. They're moving around a lot, changing careers, that kind of a thing.
Right. In fact, mobility, changing residence, changing locales. If it's within a school district or neighborhood, obviously that's not going to change your connections with others. But leaving a city and moving to an unfamiliar setting definitely increases loneliness in the short term. It can create a long-term feeling of loneliness if one doesn't actually do something about that, make an intentional effort to reconnect with new friends in the area.
I'm wondering if we're very well prepared to do that, if anyone really ever teaches us how exactly to do that.
There's no formal education, and I think that in many cases, we aren't very good at it. Our intuitions are often wrong, and the development of the digital world and social media is a good case in point. Social media is a tool, just like your car is a tool, and we often use it in ways that may feel like we're digitally connected to more people, but in fact increases our feelings of isolation. If you use the social media as a destination, you spend all your time getting more, quote, friends on Facebook, but you don't actually interact with others in a face-to-face fashion, that's been found to actually increase loneliness, not decrease loneliness.
So what is the value what's the detriment of being lonely physically? There's, of course, the emotional detriment, but they're saying that, we're finding if the U.S. Surgeon General is getting involved, we know there's a physical manifestation of this.
There is. In fact, a recent meta-analysis of studies looking at loneliness and mortality identified loneliness as increasing odds of early mortality by 26%. To put that in context, that's about the size of chronic obesity on shortening one's lifespan. And as you mentioned, it also makes life lived more miserable. Anyone who's felt lonely knows that it increases depressive symptomatology, it increases anxiety, and it just increases overall misery and decreases one's hope about moving forward in a happy and productive fashion. Those are all very deleterious effects on well-being, in addition to these physical effects.
Are Americans any more lonely than any other nationality, I guess, around the world?
Yeah, the answer is the studies have been done in industrialized nations, but that includes we've done studies in China in young and older adults, which in China, as you may know, are two very different cultures. Mm-hmm. The young were raised under a one-child regime, the old not so. And we find the level of loneliness to be about the same in industrialized nations across the world. The range is about the same. So that prevalence seems fairly constant. There's a slight difference in whether it's a collective or an independent culture. We're a very independent culture. Southern Europe, more collective. The older generations in China, more interdependent than the younger generations. And surprisingly, loneliness is slightly higher in the interdependent cultures. I say surprisingly because intuitively you would think that it wouldn't be the case, but it actually makes great sense, and we see it within a culture. If you think about the United States, people are most lonely during the holidays, during, for instance, Christmas and Hanukkah, where the cultural norm is to be connected with and enjoy the presence of friends and family. And those that either can't be with friends and family or are with them but feel burdened by that, not enjoying it, the loneliness that they feel is exacerbated. In a collectivist culture, that norm is present all year long. And so you can see how when you feel lonely, it's more intense. Of course, feeling lonely is a little bit like feeling in pain. It has an adaptive value. There's a biological utility to it. It motivates us to take care of our physical, our social body, just as pain motivates us to take care of our physical body. So an episodic a period of loneliness can be useful. It motivates you to attend to and do something about it. It's when it becomes chronic that it has these deleterious mental and physical effects, and that's less likely in a collectivist culture than in an independent culture.
We're talking about loneliness and how it affects your physical well-being. My guest is John Cacioppo. He's a neuroscientist and social psychologist at the University of Chicago and co-author of the book Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. If you have a question or comment for John Cacioppo, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How does loneliness translate into being more fragile physically? So if you get a cold, it's going to be a worse. Is it kind of you're too into yourself, or is it something more complex than that?
It's a little more complex, but you're partly right. One of the things we have found that lonely does is increase self-centeredness. It increases your focus on others, but because you're interested in your welfare and your goals, not those of others. Not too surprisingly, when we've done experiments where we've manipulated loneliness in people, their, quote, social skills go down when we make them feel lonely. When we do brain imaging, the lonely brains show less brain activity in regions that are involved in empathy and in thinking about other people's welfare. And so all of these lines converge on a greater attention to their own circumstances. And that's one of the reasons why when you get a respiratory illness, the symptoms, you pay more attention to them, and you're likely to actually go to the doctor more quickly if you feel lonely than not. Loneliness was thought early to be associated with lower healthcare utilization. We and others have found just the opposite, that it's associated with higher healthcare utilization because they're monitoring and responding to those symptoms so quickly.
Hmm. And are some kinds of people more prone to loneliness than others?
Loneliness is about 45% heritable. We've identified that in a series of twin studies and behavioral genetic studies. We've also completed now two large genome-wide association studies. And there we can look at a different kind of heritability index. It's called CHIP heritability. And it's how much of this is due to common genetic variations and to the additive effects. We know it to be polygenic. It's not one gene. It's a set of genes. And it looks like it's a large number of genes. And what that suggests is there isn't any one feature, behavioral feature, that's being selected that makes you more likely to be lonely. It's a wide range of them. But having said that genetic base, that's really only part of the story. There's a lot of environmental factors that contribute to loneliness. And in that sense, there's another nice parallel with the physical pain example that I gave you. People differ in their sensitivity to pain. Part of that's genetic. But there's a lot of environmental factors that determine whether one suffers pain frequently or in a chronic fashion or not. And so loneliness has a lot of parallels. I don't want to overemphasize the importance of the genes. They do contribute. But there's the environmental influences are also very profound and something we can do something about.
Are people necessarily good at identifying loneliness in themselves? You can have people who are busy, they're involved here and there, but they're not connecting with people.
Right.
Are they necessarily good at seeing the difference or understanding the distinction?
Yeah, first of all, somebody who's not lonely isn't necessarily someone who and doesn't connect with everybody. Moreover, popular people can be very lonely. And so it has to do, there's reasons for both of those. So if I'm connected closely with just a few people and I'm an introvert, that may be enough. And so I actually may not form strong connections with many other people. And so from the outside, it might look like I'm this fairly aloof individual, where in fact it's just that I have a very rich set of social connections that suffice, that satisfies my need for affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have people who are very popular, billionaires, for instance, have lots of people, celebrities, lots of people want to be their friends. It's hard for them to discern who's there because they actually like them versus who's there for material benefit. And for that reason, they can feel quite isolated, even though they're one of the more popular individuals in a particular setting.
Is loneliness considered sort of a mental health issue in that you should be maybe seeing a psychologist about it or what?
It's clearly a risk factor for both mental and physical health problems. We have found in experiments and in longitudinal research, and others have now found similar results showing that loneliness leads to depression. When I say depression, I mean increases depressive symptomatology. Mm-hmm. Now, that does put you at greater risk for depression, but that's actually a relatively low-frequency outcome. So the strongest effect is it increases one's sadness, and it increases that sadness over time. The effect is so if you feel lonely today, the effect of feeling lonely is not only seen next year, it's likely to last 2 years. That's what other research we've done has shown. So it's a pretty profound effect. It's, that's different than saying it's a mental health problem. Mm-hmm. I think of it as a warning sign, and it's easier to stop a problem before it develops and trying to treat the problem once it's developed. And for that reason, I think individuals in the mental health industry are also starting to look at it not as a mental health issue, but as a mental health harbinger that would be useful to attend to in order to help people avoid more serious health problems, mental health problems.
Is there any thoughts about things that people typically are doing if they're lonely? They don't realize that they're doing it. They don't realize they're being a certain way or behaving a certain way. But it's a function of loneliness, and it's unhealthy for them.
That's a wonderful question. And the answer is yes. And it's actually simple to understand, but hard for people to correct. Humans are social animals. We need others to survive and prosper. And we don't actually simply need their support. What we've been selected for is mutual aid and protection. And that's why just getting support from others won't necessarily make you feel less lonely, because you start to just feel pathetic. People in hospitals can get all the support they need, you know, instrumental support, emotional support by pressing a button. But that doesn't make them feel, you know, it's not that they are no longer likely to feel lonely in those hospitals. Because it's not the relationships that they want, and that there's no mutuality. They're not giving anything in return. Hmm. So that actually is a nice picture of humanity, that we're designed in part to be good to others and have them be good to us in return, that mutuality. When you see an animal in a herd or a fish in a school on the edge, that animal is at risk. And when they get attacked, they go into self-preservation mode. You see these herds stampede away from the predator, right? Mm-hmm. The fish create these fish balls. They're all trying to get to the middle. Well, our brains have been shaped by that evolutionary history. When we feel we don't have others in the setting who are individuals who would provide mutual aid and protection, they're people we can trust. Our brain didn't get designed to simply count conspecifics. It wants to know friend or foe. Are there others who are going to harm me or who are going to be hospitable and I can work with? And so that feeling of isolation in a public setting, in a social setting, leads the brain to fall into a self-preservation mode. It's phylogenetically so old, you're not aware of it. And what that then does is we've done brain imaging studies where we actually find neural networks associated with alertness and regulatory control to actually change their level of activation at baseline, just when you're sitting in a scanner resting, because the brain is now in a mode where it's looking for potential threats, particularly social threats, threats from other
individuals. Because you feel alone.
Because you feel alone. Huh. If I feel lonely in a setting, that means my brain does not see mutual aid and protection in that setting. And so when something negative happens in that setting, that individual has to worry about themselves. They don't have the luxury of worrying about somebody else because they don't have the same confidence that others will be there to protect them. And that then leads us to think about others and interact too quickly with others in ways that have assumed, built on the premise that they may be a threat. And again, there's an evolutionary reason. I can't overcome a fatal assault. If I mistake a foe as a friend, then I don't live to reproduce. If I mistake somebody who's in fact hospitable as a potential foe, that error can be corrected. And so our brain has been sculpted to over emphasize the potential threats others make, and we don't know it, and so we're acting toward others in a way that can actually bring out hostile behavior toward us because of how we're treating others.
John Cacioppo, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
John Cacioppo, neuroscientist and social psychologist at the University of Chicago, author, co-author of the book Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 50 years ago, Catherine Schweitzer made history when she became the first woman to run in the Boston Marathon, even as race officials at the time tried to physically remove her from the course, which at the time did not allow women and didn't for another 5 years, I think. On Monday, she ran the race again, this time at the age of 70, finishing in 4 hours and 44 minutes. That's just 24 minutes slower than her first Boston Marathon. We're talking about training and age today when it comes to marathons. Tom McGlynn is a three-time Olympic marathon trials qualifier and the founder of Run Coach, an online training program. He coached Christine Kennedy when she became the oldest woman to break 3 hours in the Boston Marathon in 2014 at the age of 59. Gives people like me hope. Tom joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's great to be here. And really excited that you mentioned Catherine. She's certainly an inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. She was 20 years old when she ran in the Boston Marathon in 1967. On Monday at age 70, she finished 24 minutes slower. That's incredible. I mean, does age have that much of an effect on your ability to do something like that?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, you know, as we age, we do lose some muscle that hurts. But the good news is that you can always improve your aerobic economy. So how you use your oxygen, and Catherine and Christine, and there's many other examples of that. As you age, you can always, improve that aerobic economy. So, and Catherine showed that again on Monday in very difficult weather conditions.
It was kind of warm, wasn't it?
Yes, very warm.
Yeah, 4 hours and 44 minutes. That's good for her age?
I'd say that's tremendous for her age. In fact, I didn't look up what her age graded score is, but it should be, it should be pretty significant. She did, yeah.
Are you finding when it comes to your online program that more people of age are interested in this sort of exertion?
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the things we see is that we have two programs. We have a program called Run Coach, which is for recreational runners, and we partner with the Columbus Half Marathon and Marathon, and have about 300 trainees training for that race. And then we have a solution called Move Coach, which targets corporate employees. And overall, our biggest participation range is the 20 to 40-year-old, so ages 20 to 40-year-old. But when we look at individuals who complete their goals most frequently and actually log the most miles, it is 40 to 60-year-old, and more specifically, it's 50 to 60-year-olds. And we're not quite sure what to make of that other than we think that age demographic is very focused on, following a plan, setting a goal, and really adhering to it. So we think it's really interesting data.
You said that we lose muscle as we age. Does that affect the impact of stretching when it comes to something like running?
Yeah, it can. It can. I mean, what we really think is kind of that perfect life balance is some kind of aerobic activity like running, complemented with a stretching routine, which could be done through yoga, three times a week yoga, or anything else like that. But if you stick with, again, you know, if you stick with the flexibility program, you should remain relatively flexible. We do know for certain that, you know, as runners, we become less flexible, actually, running overall with the muscle activation actually shortens the muscle fiber. So flexibility and stretching is very important.
So running often without stretching will eventually affect your ability to run?
It could. We find that, you know, the muscles become pretty specific, so they get used to running and that they can keep going. We just think that, you know, kind of the perfect scenario and recipe is probably a flexibility routine as well, a consistent flexibility routine mixed in.
Are you seeing more running neophytes shooting for a marathon right off the bat?
Yeah, so it's kind of peaked out to a degree. We see the running industry follow the kind of the economic industry to a degree in terms of whenever there's a recession, we see running really boom. And, you know, there hasn't been a recession in almost 10 years. So we've kind of seen running, I think it peaked out around 2010, 2011 in terms of marathon finishers. And it's slowly kind of gone down just a bit. We do see kind of the most popular distance is the half marathon. And in general, that's kind of the race that we recommend as the, you know, if you really want to come off the couch, or if you're not a runner at this point, you want to aim for something. We like that half marathon distance a little bit better just because of the pounding of 26 miles and what's involved in the training and the kind of the risk reward proposition of injury versus benefit. So we love that half marathon distance, and we also love, for someone coming off the couch, the idea of targeting a 5K. So if you look at, you know, basically a 3 mile run or 3 mile walk, we think that's very attainable, and there's lots of them available in the summer in Ohio, and then just about wherever you are, there's usually races, particularly 5Ks, available to you.
How long does it take to train for something like a marathon?
So for a marathon, if you are active, so if you're running, and when I say running, you're probably running 3 times a week, around 10 miles, then we would recommend about 18 weeks, so about four to five months. And if you're inactive, if you're not running, then we would say anywhere from 6 to 8 months, because essentially what you have to start with is that initial pounding and the initial introduction to running, which again would be 2 to 3 times a week, 2 to 3 miles, that kind of thing, and then obviously building up to, you know, at least 16 mile long runs to get ready for that 26 miles.
And when you first start out, is it wise to, I mean, just run as long as you can, or should you be pacing yourself at first if you're not, you know, a 10 mile a pop runner 3 times a week?
Yeah, great question. You definitely want to start off gradual. And really what we like to think about in, you know, to become a runner is the idea of that second step. And so we see a lot of individuals who will start and they'll go on a long run. They'll come right off the couch and run 5 miles, and maybe they'll even do that for a week or two, but that almost always leads to injury. So what we really encourage individuals to do is kind of to think about running like a marathon, in the sense that we're going to build up to a longer distance. So the best thing to do right away is to go to a running store, a local running store, get fitted for a pair of shoes that are just going to be for your runs, and really set up a plan where, okay, I'm going to do 3 days a week. And those 3 days a week might start with a 5 to 10 minute walk that eventually become walk run. So I'm, you know, walking 2 minutes, and then I'm running a minute, and I'm getting 10 minutes in, and then the next week I'm getting 12 minutes in 3 times a week. That kind of gradual increase, so about a 10% increase, is very, very effective. And the other thing I'll just add on that is that I know that there was just a recent article in the New York Times about the adding time to your life from running, but there was also a previous article that is about a month old on a longitudinal study of runners, a big study that spanned 40 or 50 years, and they found that reduced morbidity even from running 10 minutes a week at 10 minute per mile pace. So you think about that, that's 3 or 4 miles a week. They saw effects from that. They saw long-term benefits. So when we think about just getting out the door for 10 minutes, it can be impactful.
How much should people think about what they're putting in their bodies, what they're eating, what they're consuming when it comes to a marathon-type training schedule?
So in general, as you start to run, you will need a few more calories, and we think about carbs as being the most efficient in terms of, you know, converting to glycogen, which is basically the, you know, the sugar, the fuel in our body. I like to encourage natural foods, so there's a number of powders and kind of lotions and potions that you can use, but we think there's a lot of benefit from fruits and vegetables, good healthy carbs that you know that are have a lot of fluid in them. So I think overall, what we recommend on the nutritional side is to try and really eat a balanced diet of the macronutrients and kind of leading with all natural foods in general, and then, you know, just give yourself a little bit of a break on adherence to kind of caloric restrictions, in the sense that as your activity increases, you're going to need a few more calories. But the idea is obviously helpful impact and benefits. So we just have to be aware of kind of overeating, which is kind of a frequent result of marathon training.
And I know, you know, you're the founder of Run Coach. It's an online training program. How does that work? How does an online training program work?
Well, in general, online training programs, you normally download a plan and then you follow a plan. And we actually started. So when I say a plan, you could download like the 18-week beginner plan for a half marathon.
Uh-huh.
And it would give you kind of a week-by-week outline of what to do. We actually created Run Coach under the auspice that people will get interrupted with daily life. So there'll be an 18-week plan, but on the 14th week, something will blow up in life and we'll have to take a week off. And we created Run Coach so that you can recalculate that, so we can look at your training log and we can get the data from the Run Coach app or from a Garmin device or an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, and we can analyze the data and say, okay, you took a week off. Let's recalculate your plan and have you build up gradually again and adjust your plan all the way leading up to the event or the race or whatever you want to accomplish. And then participants can also access a coach if they get stuck and they can ask a question about training. That's how our program works.
Can you train for a marathon on a treadmill?
Absolutely. Yes, you can. You can definitely train. And actually, the treadmill running is great. You can get essentially almost the exact same stress in terms of the aerobic benefits on a treadmill. I think they're great. Obviously, you guys deal with the winter, and most of us do in the U.S., so treadmill running is terrific. The only thing I would say, the only thing that a treadmill won't do, because you can incline a treadmill, you can run up a hill.
Uh-huh.
In a race like Boston, the beginning of the course is net downhill, so you're running a lot of downhill.
Yeah.
The one thing you can't really condition for on a treadmill is running down a hill, and running downhill is... obviously, you run faster, you have more exposure to gravity, so it's actually the most intense pounding on the legs. It's the highest risk of injury, so that's the only thing you can't do on a treadmill is train to run downhill.
So that's a good question. I mean, we're just about out of time, of course, but as far as running downhill, do you employ some kind of weightlifting or something to strengthen those muscles?
You could, yeah, definitely. You know, you could do some squats, even body weight. You know, no weight, just body weight squats is probably the probably the best for that. But at the end of the day, we find that, you know, the best way to train to run downhill is to
run
is
downhill.
To do a little bit of downhill running.
Okay. Yeah. No shortcuts. Tom McGlynn, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, Ann.
Tom McGlynn, 3-time Olympic Marathon Trials qualifier and founder of Run Coach, an online training program. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.